this week on Retronauts, it's a true battle of governors. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and today's topic is the movie The Running Man, the 1987 movie that influenced quite a few games. Before I continue, who is here with me in the same room today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and I'm going to be sticking on my pinkies the entire podcast, just like Richard Dawson does.
And who is our special guest on the line?
It's Jeremy Parrish, the jogging man. Ooh, I'm not quite man. Up. I don't have the stamina to run. Sorry.
I'm the elliptical man. I run in place and look
Actually,
ridiculous.
Actually, that's what I do. Yeah.
It's a good workout. But yes, so Jeremy, you've done quite a few of these movie-based episodes where you talk about the movie, its influence on culture and the games that are based on it, and I'm going to try my hand at the very same thing.
I can't believe you haven't done one yet.
I can't believe it either. I'm doing one on The Running Man, as I said up front. It's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, but I feel like it's his most overlooked of the Schwarzenegger canon of the 80s. It is still fairly popular in terms of movies. I mean, there's a Blu-ray release. You can watch it streaming on Amazon Prime. It's not an obscure movie. Nothing with Schwarzenegger in it is truly an obscure movie, but it's not one you hear talked about that often, but I think it had a pretty big influence on games. It hit the right people at the right time, and they influenced game design, and that is my crazy hypothesis.
It's less obscure than Hercules in New York. But,
that is true.
But yes, I think it's not on the level of a Terminator or even a Twins, I'd say, or Predator from the same year. Like this, it's slightly lesser known, but man, watching it today, I was struck once more of like how prescient Richard Bachman was.
And
how
the whole politics in this and the social elements of it are like, wow, it's this movie could be describing 2019, although it's actually describing 2017.
Actually, the opening crawl says 2017, but the movie actually takes place in 2019. It's confusing. So that makes us very appropriate. I didn't realize that until I was like hours into my research, like, 2019.
Oh, yeah, because the opening is like a prologue and then he's in prison for 2 years.
That's right.
18 months later is when the prison opens up. So yeah, it is 2019. We are in the same year as Running Man.
We will talk, we don't want to bring anyone down, but it's very depressing about how the 1980s bad future just became our future. I mean, Back to the Future 2 is probably the ultimate example of that.
Yeah.
But also RoboCop.
Yeah, I mean, this is the future we see in The Running Man and RoboCop, like the crass capitalist future where life and death is a game show, is kind of what we're living
in.
And
we're
in
all
now.
Just living satire, and we love it. We love it, don't we?
I tweet about it all the time.
I mean,
I tell you about 30 to 50 feral boars.
Oh, God. Oh, we made another feral boar reference on a podcast we recorded today, Jeremy.
And well, now people will know exactly the date that we recorded this because that has an expiration date of less than 24 hours.
This is a historical document now, but I feel like the bad future writers of the 80s did not go far enough with their imagination. They could not imagine the bad future we're currently living in, but hopefully we'll make your future better with good podcasts. But I was looking at the history of this movie. I've done a lot of research on this, and I was surprised. Like, it wasn't like a mega hit. It was kind of a flop for Schwarzenegger at the time. I mean, it made back its budget, but not by much. And obviously Predator was the bigger movie he was in at the time, and this would soon be eclipsed by things like Terminator 2 and Kindergarten Cop and everything that would follow. But this is like in the Schwarzenegger bubble, where it was like the beefy, sweaty, oily action stars that would be the heroes of our video games from the 80s.
Yep.
The outsized personalities with giant impossible physiques, which we're in again now. Like, well, films like The Fast and the Furious are kind of throwbacks in that style. About like what if the main characters are muscle men?
I would say like the super beef chunk style of hot dudes is kind of out of date. So yeah, like Fast and Furious is very retro in that sense. It's more like everyone now is very, very lean muscle. So they basically just have zero body fat. And Like you could squeeze them through the slats in a white picket fence because they're very thin.
It's the they're all like shaved too.
Well, like, I think what ruined it was UFC. That UFC taught you like, well, who's the best fighter in these shows? It's not guys who are bodybuilders. Bodybuilders are not the best fighters. They usually have more, you know, lean physiques for movement. They're imposing. Definitely strong, yeah. For sure, but yeah.
I mean, I was looking at that Hobbs and Shaw movie poster. I'm like, one of these guys has got to have hair. I'm sorry. They're just two big, pink, veiny guys. They're too similar.
Yeah.
That's the future Choaniki was predicting.
It's true. That's the I guess it's good if you're into that, but
well, look, you can't expect with the amount of steroids that The Rock takes, you can't expect him to keep all his hair. I know the film jokes that steroids make you deaf, but they actually make you lose your hair faster.
Yes, and many other problems. But I want to ask you guys your history with this movie. I found it kind of late because, of course, I had seen the Terminator movies and I had seen other things. And I know like games like Smash TV, we'll talk about that later, references a lot and other games references. But I never had really seen it until maybe like 5 or 6 years ago. It was on Netflix or something. And I was like, I'll watch this. And I walked away saying, wow, this is such a fun popcorn movie, a very tightly paced movie, and a very fun movie if you're into video games. And it was fairly new to me, and it still kind of is. Henry, how about you?
You know, I had kind of a long time to see it, too. I didn't see it in the 90s because it wasn't, you know, marketed to me the way other 80s Arnold classics were, in the case of especially Predator and Terminator. Like, those I knew as important films to see then. And meanwhile, Running Man, like, it wasn't really being aired for free on a channel, and I wasn't going to seek it out. It wasn't until, like, the late 2000s, I think, was when I finally saw it for the first time in a postmodern appreciation context. And now I do really, really love it as it gets more and more accurate. I mean, it scratches the same itch as legitimately my favorite movie of all time, RoboCop. Like, very, very similar place in my heart. And so I love it now, and I especially love seeing, you know, how obviously video games took off from it, too.
And Jeremy, you were 12 when this movie came out, so you would have been old enough to sneak into The Running Man. When did you first encounter it in your life?
About 22 hours ago.
Wow. So you were a Running Man virgin then.
Yeah, I'm not really a Schwarzenegger fan, and like there are some movies he's been in that I really enjoy, but I'm not a fan of him specifically. And I don't know, this one just never called out to me. So having watched it, I can appreciate its entertainment value, but I had a hard time getting into it because every single character in this movie except Yaphet Kotto is just completely unlikable. Like I feel like this is really the movie where Schwarzenegger's quip personality kind of took over and became more important than any like actual character development or script development. Like every single person he murders, he's got some sort of punchline before he kills him. And then after he kills him, it's like he gets you coming and going.
He's quipping his head off in this movie.
It is so quippy.
This is the stuff like McBain is making fun of on The Simpsons.
Like he had his personal quip writer come in and give a pass on the script. He's like, we ought to lighten the mood here with some funny lines here.
Nothing is more jovial than joking about a man you just murdered.
Yeah, to split. Yeah, this movie, again, it's like not a fine work of art. It's just a goofy action movie. You have to kind of come into it with that mindset. But in case you want to know what it's about, it's about a wrongfully convicted man who is forced to take part in a Boss Rush style reality show to serve his term. Also, it's 2019. This could sound familiar to some of you out there. Society is broken down. The government controls and censors all media and art and also has their own state-run TV station, etc. Again, it's very much the same RoboCop-style future that was predicted in the 80s.
I think RoboCop was slightly more commercial than this is. This veers more to totalitarianism. Like,
yeah.
It is officially state TV instead of, like, the government. What I love about RoboCop is the government is so broke that they can just be bought by a company. Like OCP is like, we own the cops now.
They kind of gave up the government in RoboCop.
In this case, the government is like, no, we are everything. We are television.
They don't explore much of the lore of the Running Man world, but I do enjoy the things you hear like on the monitors in the background. You do also see like there are slums where people live, but also Maria Cachito Alonso's character, she is like, she's a sellout to the state, so she gets to live in a nice apartment. It's not super nice, but it's better than living in the slum. So you see like the different strata of people.
Right, and apparently this entire movie takes place either in Blade Runner's Los Angeles or maybe Mega Tokyo from Bubblegum Crisis. It's got those kind of like megalithic structures. There's giant, like, it's a much more monolithic Los Angeles than actually exists, with like kind of ziggurat looking buildings in the background that just go, you know, a mile into the sky.
When Ben Richards, as Arnold's character is ridiculously named, when he breaks out of prison and it's nighttime and you see that first matte painting of was it Los Angeles?
Yeah, it's LA.
Yeah, it is beautiful. It's beautiful and it's just disgustingness, but I kind of miss matte paintings.
I love those matte paintings. I mean, it's hilarious to see. You can see where the line is. You know where it is, but I just love the tactileness. This sounds like an old man, but I love the tactileness of just knowing that you're looking at glass, painted glass in front of a camera instead of just something green screened in later, you know, like it's not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not like when you see the behind the scenes stuff for an Avengers movie and it's just like, so here are the rocks and the green screen warehouse and everyone's run there and I'll run there.
Everyone's wearing a green spandex. And here they're wearing yellow spandex. It's totally different.
Wow, shaking things up. Yeah, they film every movie in the green factory now, but before you had to paint things, damn it. So this movie, I want to talk about where it came from. It's based on the 1982 novel by Richard Bachman, a.k.a. Stephen King. And my explanation of this is Bachman was basically Stephen King's Ultra Games label, in which he used it as a way to publish more books under the same publisher, because they're like, we can only publish so many books you write, because it's just flooding the market. People will get bored of you. But it's like, what if I'm Richard Bachman instead? And that is essentially what he did in the 80s. And he also...
Yeah, that was kind of his label for sort of the substandard books, like the really big classics, like The Stand, The Shining, It, Carrie, Christine. Those were all Stephen King, whereas it was like thinner, or The Running Man, like kind of minor works that weren't quite so memorable, weren't quite so well thought out, were clearly written in like a week under a cocaine haze.
Yes.
That's Richard Bachman.
These were Stephen King's drug days, of course. He has gotten over all that stuff. He survived being run over by a van. He's doing great. He's funny on Twitter. But he normally had around 3 months to write a novel of this size. It's about 300 pages. He wrote it in a week, and you can only write a book in a week with drugs.
I mean, it was the 80s. It was cocaine. Like, it's just all... I mean, well, and for a story about a desperate man worried he's being watched at every turn, like, that is some real cocaine energy to that story, too.
Yeah, and the 80s were, if you weren't alive then, they were huge for... I mean, Stephen King has been a huge since he started writing in the 70s, but the 80s were big. It was the biggest decade for Stephen King movies, period. Like, everything he did was mined for a movie. Like, every short story from, like, Skeleton Crew or Graveyard Shift or whatever, those all became movies. They let him direct his own movie. That's how crazy things were.
I think his best movie for decades was the 90s, though. He got Shawshank Redemption and a few others in there.
Yeah, I think...
So this was just like the glut, whereas in the 90s, they took a little time to step back and bring you some refinement.
The quality movies that come in the 90s, of course, The Shining, even though it deviated from the book immensely, is probably the best Stephen King adaptation, even though it just swerves wildly from the source material.
But... Yeah, I mean, he also wasn't writing classier stuff in the 80s compared... Like, Green Mile can be made into more of an Oscar-winning type, and same with Shawshank. Not that I don't particularly like the Green Mile movie. I think it's bad.
Yeah, but, there's a lot of problems with that one, but I love Shawshank Redemption. I think it's a fantastic movie. It's one that sticks with you for a while.
And that is just a short story he wrote in one of those collections. But yeah, I want to talk, I didn't read the book. I kind of wanted to, and I kind of want to now. Like, what does a book written in a week read like? So the book is fairly different than the movie. So King describes Ben Richards, who is Schwarzenegger in the movie, as scrawny and pre-tubercular. So way different than the just cut from like Golden Flesh magazine Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie.
Well, and it's I'm always impressed by how being in jail for 18 months, he has lost no muscle mass or anything.
No, they're feeding him lots of protein in that prison.
But yeah, this guy, well, the guy sounds like more of a regular Joe, which you then have to, and also a guy who can lose, which in the 80s, it definitely sounded like if Schwarzenegger is going to say yes to your movie, he's victorious in the end and looks cool.
Yeah, he has to punch back everyone who punches him, just like Hobbs and Shaw.
That's the tagline, they punch back. But yeah, I think the only reason King didn't make that character a writer is because people would know Stephen King was writing the book. That's the only reason why Ben Richards couldn't be a writer.
I hear they still go to Maine in the book, though.
It all takes place in Maine. Actually, in the movie The Running Man, it takes place, it's a game show, it takes place on the ruins of the great earthquake of 1997. It basically turned that into a set. In The Running Man,
yeah, they said it was like 40 square blocks or something.
Something like that in Southern California.
They give it an exact size, yeah.
But it's just like one of the background things you kind of hear that builds the world. But in the book, The Running Man, it takes place potentially across the entire world. And that you basically have to survive 30 days while you are being stalked by hitmen. So it takes place wherever you want it to take place. You're just constantly on the run. Hence, the title The Running Man makes more sense in that sense than as you are in this game show.
Yeah, it's actually sounded more like Amazing Race or something.
Yeah, yeah, except with that show needs more hitmen.
Yeah, more hit. Well, I watched this really helpful video about this called What's the Difference? It's a really good video series they do about once a month, just comparing the book or comic book that a film is based on and getting really granular into the differences between them. And the one for this had a lot of interesting stuff in it, yeah.
The ending of this is much different than the ending in which Ben is victorious. Spoilers. The ending of the book is that he basically hijacks a plane and he crashes it into the TV network building, which kills Damon Killian, who is the character in the book as well, the game show host character.
Yeah, well, though, apparently on the What's the Difference thing, they did say that Killian's not even the host. He's the executive producer, but not also
the
host.
That's right. He's just the leader of the games network or whatever runs The Running Man.
And that the hitmen in it are just plain hitmen. They are not crazy video game bosses.
Yeah,
either.
Which sounds like it sounds worse
to
me.
That's boring.
Yeah. And we'll talk.
I can't believe that was written on cocaine.
Not
I feel
crazy
like cocaine
enough.
Would have been just like wild.
Maybe it wasn't good cocaine. Who knows?
Okay.
He got a better dealer when he wrote Cujo.
The coke equivalent of skunk weed.
Yes, exactly. And we'll talk more about the writer, but apparently the writer did play games, at least when he wrote Street Fighter, so maybe he was thinking of video games while writing this. Let's talk about the movie now. It released on November 13th, 1987. I was five. I was probably more interested in watching, let's say, the Care Bears movie 2. Who knows what was out in 1987.
Or real Ghostbusters, maybe.
Yeah. Directed by Paul Michael Glazer, who is on the commentary of the Blu-ray. He is not a huge film director, more of a TV guy who made a few movies, and he did lots of acting before he was a director. I believe one of his first roles was he was in the film adaptation of Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's nice.
And you might be surprised to know that he is Jewish.
Oh, well.
I know it's shocking.
I'm shocked.
Yes, but he directed things like, he directed episodes of Starsky and Hutch and Miami Vice. And the other movies he directed are a few infamous ones. So we have things like The Cutting Edge. I forget what that is. The Air Up There.
It's about
with Kevin
ice skaters.
It is. It is. It's a good name for an
oh,
ice
the
skating
Air Up
movie.
There. I remember that. That's the... The Kevin Bacon goes to Africa to get basketball players. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah. It's kind of a, like in the same, I think the same little box as The Gods Must Be Crazy.
Yeah.
Kevin Bacon gets his foreskin cut off in that movie.
Wow. Set the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Well, that's so Kevin Bacon can join the tribe before he can get them to sign up for basketball.
Is this like a, have you seen this?
I saw this in theaters.
I would remember that scene if I had seen that.
It only hit me afterwards when I realized what, I didn't know what circumcision was. So then I found out. But anyway.
That's what the movie was there for, to teach you. Also director of Kazam, the famous Sinbad movie. Of course, it's Shaquille O'Neal,
yes,
I know.
Yes, yes, yes.
And Band of the Hands. Actually, Schwarzenegger did not like him because he came from TV. Mm. The movie he directed before this was Band of the Hand, not a big movie. And Schwarzenegger thought the director was going to be Andrew Davis, who actually did some principal photography, but the movie was running way over budget and way behind schedule. And Andrew Davis was fired 2 weeks into production, and this guy was put on as like the fifth choice.
Damn.
So Andrew Davis would go on to direct The Fugitive, which everyone remembers that movie, the 1992 Fugitive.
Now that's a running man.
They could have called that movie The Running Man.
I think back then, especially the idea of being a TV director was a lot more shame. Now, like, the guys who directed the biggest, the most money-making film of all time were TV directors, the Russo brothers. Like, I think there is a little less shame in it. Also, because big budget movies are TV now, so they don't want the fancy directors.
It's true, and all the good directors used to come from music videos, but they don't make those anymore.
Yes,
so
yeah, there's also that. Yeah,
no more McG's in this world.
I mean, I think Schwarzenegger is probably upset as well because he's just like, he's an alpha, you know, and he doesn't want some beta TV director coming in and telling him what to do. Like, Schwarzenegger, even then in 87, like, he's, if you watch his Mr. Olympia movie, it's a Pumping Iron. It's all about the head games he plays. Like, he is a master manipulator on top of being an incredibly fit man.
I believe on the commentary, which I listened to this morning, the director was talking about how Arnold was very bossy on the set, especially with him. And he kind of came up to Arnold and is like, "Hey, Arnold, you're from Austria, right? I'm Jewish. How do you think I feel when you boss me around?"
Oh,
and
damn.
I think he acted a little better after that.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Damn.
That is Paul Michael Glazer. He's still acting, no longer directing. I think he was recently in that Netflix show with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin.
Oh, yeah. I know the show.
Yeah. But it's on. You can watch it if you want. But again, fifth director, sort of a last-minute choice. He has a pretty good job. But the screenplay is by the king of the 80s, Stephen E. D'Souza. Once you hear what he makes, you'll know what this movie is. So he has written things like 48 Hours and Jumpin' Jack Flash, Die Hard 1 and 2, Hudson Hawk, and also he wrote and directed the Street Fighter movie. So he's done a lot, but he is the master of the quippy action romp, really from the 80s.
Now he's a master of quippy dialogue, just like, I can think of a line from at least several of these, not Jumpin' Jack Flash, but even Street Fighter, I think a problem with the Street Fighter movie is that it came a decade too late, because all the dumb crap Jean-Claude Van Damme says in it would have been entirely acceptable in 1995 or 1985, but it was just hokey by the time it hit around then.
It has a lot of camp value now, especially Raul Julia's stuff. Like, all the stuff you remember him saying, like, "For me, it was Tuesday." Those are all Stephen E. D'Souza quips.
One, Stephen E. D'Souza learned from, like, this movie, Die Hard, and others, that, like, you need a great actor who is not physically imposing to go as the villain to go against your meathead actor. And that was the case with Raul Julia against Jean-Claude Van Damme. Same here with Richard Dawson and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not really a fair fight. Although the biggest surprise I have here is that Hudson Hawk had a script.
Yep.
Yeah, that was just entirely off the cuff by Bruce Willis.
I've never seen the movie. I just know it was touted like as one of the, it's going to be the biggest thing. Here's the NES game.
They play the game in the movie, don't they?
Do they?
They might very well.
You'll have to wait for
by Ocean.
You'll have to wait for a Hudson Hawk episode to find out about that. But yeah, that's Stephen E. D'Souza. This could just be good PR for the Street Fighter movie, but one of his credentials was when he was writing the movie, they were saying, well, he loves the video game, so he's the best choice. I don't know if they're making that up, but possibly he was a gamer in the 80s, and he was thinking about video games when he was writing this movie in 1986. Henry?
I want to believe that. I think... You know, that does sound like easy PR to just say that in interviews, but also I don't think PR people in 95 were really thinking about courting the gamers and having the, you know, bullet point that they would totally have 10 years later in interviews of like, no, the director of Tomb Raider is a real gamer.
Yeah.
They really
play
video games.
The average gamer in 1987 was like 11 years old. So that wasn't really like a key market. It was you know, their parents. That's who they wanted to reach.
But I mean, this definitely has video game sensibilities to it that I would think maybe came from a guy. Maybe not in 1986 video games, maybe not as much, but I still feel a little of it.
Yeah. I really want to talk more about that later, just like how this and video games sort of like figured out bosses at the same time. But let's talk about the cast really quick before we go into just a general discussion of the movie. Of course, we all know him, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Ben Richards. I love movies with him in it where he's just like, I'm Steve Thompson. It's yes, like, let's yeah. not explain how you
I'm
look.
I'm Steve Thompson.
Exactly. Let's not explain how you look or your accent or your background. You're Jim Richards.
Some women and children down there. They're hungry. It just wants food.
I'm going to try to avoid doing an Arnold accent. But one thing we forget about. So I totally forgot that Jesse Ventura, who we'll talk about soon, he was governor of Minnesota. And then Arnold was governor of California. So Arnold being governor of California overwrote Jesse Ventura being governor of Minnesota as the most ridiculous thing. And now that our president is the crazy game show host from this movie, we forget that he was governor of California
for
8 years.
Just kind of goes away.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that, you know, when you talk about the path of reality in that direction, it makes you wonder in 2030 what we're going to say. Like, can you believe we used to think it was crazy Donald Trump was president? Like, what will we say then? What happens then? Where are we then? I'm scared.
It's why I stopped writing satire a few months ago. It's like, I can't do this anymore. Reality is outpacing me. But yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger, again, this was a huge, huge era for him. He would only start falling off in the 90s with stuff like Last Action Hero. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was getting older, of course.
Times
now
changed, too. Like, people by the mid-90s, like, Schwarzenegger stuff was old hat.
And now, I mean, he is kind of progressive in some ways for being Republican. He's big on climate change and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When a lot of people will not say anything about it. I mean, I don't know how much I can trust him. He's had some scandals since in recent times. So his mighty heart is breaking.
No, I mean, he's, you know, on the Republican end of things, he's, you know, more liberal, I suppose, and that he's a California Republican. They in general are, like, you can't. A Mississippi Republican does not get elected in California. So even if you're a Republican in California, the scale slides a little bit. He's also, you know, he takes shots at, or at least was when he was hosting the fucking game show that our president starred in when he was the second host of it.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, see? At all, things happen too much.
It's true. I mean, I feel like a kind of progressive or kind of open-minded Republican governor in 2004 is the equivalent of a kind of moderate Democrat today, the way things are sliding.
Right.
We shall see.
Politics.
Yeah,
everyone loves them.
I feel like Schwarzenegger's star began to tarnish in the 90s in large part because of a movie that we've already mentioned, which was released contemporaneously with The Running Man, which was Die Hard. Because, you know, Bruce Willis is kind of a meathead, sure, but he was a much more realistic meathead. Like, he was kind of a normal guy in good shape, and he got the crap beaten out of him throughout that movie. Mm. And not in, like, a showy kind of way, but in, like, a, oh, you can tell this guy is really hurting. And by the end of it, you know, he's holding on by pure grit. And that was, I think, much more convincing. So you ended up with action movies more along the lines of something like The Fugitive, where, you know, it's Harrison Ford, but he's not Indiana Jones. He's just a doctor who is desperate to clear his own name. And that was a very intense, memorable movie. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, the style of movie felt really dated and out of style by that point.
And by the 90s, you had the Michael Bay films, which his main characters are usually like average Joes.
Yeah.
Like Nick Cage in The Rock or Ben Affleck in Armageddon. Like, guys are like, hey, I'm just a guy who drills rocks, and I guess I got to go in out of space or something here. Huh?
I'm drilling here. Oh, wow. Yeah, so that's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Again, cool guy. Why not?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
He's He made all of our 80s dreams come true. So up next, we have Maria Cachita Alonso as Amber Mendez. She came from Latin American telenovelas, moved to America in 1984, and had her film debut in Robin Williams' movie I haven't seen, Moscow on the Hudson.
Yeah, I kind of forget that. I mean, in that movie, he's just doing a Yakov Smirnoff impersonation, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure he walks around various places saying, "What the country?" And she never became a megastar. She was also in, I think, Predator 2?
Yes.
Yeah, Predator 2. Yeah. But if you look at her IMDb, she just has never stopped working, and she's gorgeous to this day. So.
Yeah, no, she's a very pretty lady who... Well,
and
she...
Arnold is also gorgeous to this day.
Yeah, but he's...
I don't know about to this day, but in this movie, he's definitely kind of like peak of good looks. He's like the very model of Teutonic handsomeness.
He's doing fine at 39, I gotta say.
He's a very Aryan handsomeness. I mean, oh, actually, I remember the last time I saw him in the news. So it went viral where he was at some school somewhere on Earth, and a kid tries to drop kick him, or a kid does kick him, but the kid just bounces off of him and falls down.
I saw a video of that. It's just like, what would happen if, like, I don't know, like a leaf hits you from a tree? Mm. You're walking down the sidewalk.
I mean, I'm certain Arnold Schwarzenegger could murder me right now, like very easily.
From Southern California.
Yes, exactly.
That is Maria Cachita Alonso. But another superstar in this movie is Richard Dawson as Damon Killian, the villain of this movie. Now, this was some real stunt casting because 2 years before this movie, he ended a 9-year run as the host of Family Feud. Mm. So for us, this is like, wait, who hosts the game show today?
It was Richard Karn. Is it still Karn? Or did it I think it was either Richard Karn or Elaine's boss from Seinfeld.
Let's say it's like this would be like having a movie like this today with
Family Feud is Steve Harvey.
It's Steve
isn't it?
Harvey. Yeah. Duh.
It would be like Steve Harvey or Louis Anderson being in this role, or like Alex Trebek being the leader of the sadistic game show. But
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. But he is so good in this movie. He gets it. He understands what he has to do. And he is a lot of fun to watch.
He's so good. Everything he does is so good. He's really playing himself there, too. He's great. But he has his pinkies out. Every time he's drinking his thing, he has his pinkies out. He's so fancy.
He's a fancy boy.
Yeah. But also, like, I love him. His two-facedness, such a great introduction to his character. Where he slips on that stuff that guy's mopping. He's like, "Hey, you're doing a great job. What's your name? Get this guy out of here."
Yeah, it's a good screenplay moment. It's like kind of the kick the cat moment.
Yeah, he rules in everything he does in this. He's the real draw of the film, and that he just came straight from being on Family Feud, which I don't know if you've seen his Family Feuds. He's a very friendly host.
Remember. He's very handsy with the with the moms.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Family Feud thing is that you are like right there with a lot of very normal people, or maybe subnormal even, and you have to kind of put on a game face and be like, "Wow, you just said something incredibly stupid, but let's look to the board." So I feel like this is just kind of, you know, like a natural evolution of that. Just taking sort of the natural personality he had to display during Family Feud and putting a malicious twist on it.
He has a very good and fun to watch insincerity to what he does. Like when he's talking to people in the audience and like kissing the ladies, having his hand around people and stuff. It's very sleazy and insincere, and it's just fun to watch. So Richard Dawson does so good in this movie. Also, other people in this movie, Yaphet Kotto. These other characters have names apparently, but that are rarely ever uttered. But his name is William Laughlin. But he played Parker in Alien. I believe he did an Alien episode. Is that correct, Jeremy?
Yes, absolutely. He's one of the space mechanics working in the bowels of the Nostromo.
That's right. And he doesn't get a lot to do in this, but he's good at what he does. He's just a reliable buddy.
There's a great little character building line for him at the start where Arnold says to him, like, "Keep trying to teach children the Constitution." It's just like he's still a believer in the old American government that is long dead. But that's but that too, I like that Ben Richards in this is so apolitical compared to what I heard he is in the book. He's much more of a politically engaged guy.
Yeah, and like something that's lost in the script, and I guess we could talk about it later, is that Ben Richards goes through an arc, but the points are so far apart in time. Like, you get one line, it's like, I only look out for myself. And then like at the end of the movie, he's like, oh, I can help lead people. I have a cause now. Now I'm like fighting for other people. But they're just so separate, and there's so much mayhem in between those two points that the character doesn't really grow in this movie. And that's Yaphet Kotto. And then we have Jesse Ventura as Captain Freedom, who is so good in this movie. He rules. I love him strutting around the aerobics video.
Oh, so good.
He is so good. We all know him today as a conspiracy kook. I barely knew him as a wrestler. By the time I knew of him, he was the governor of Minnesota.
I know where the black boxes are, Bob. I am doing James Doney's impersonation.
If you hear
I did not know he's a conspiracy kook.
Oh, the Denver airport, Jeremy.
That's surprising.
I host conspiracy theories on True TV. I've been to the 9/11 site, and I know what happened there.
It's a fun voice because you can do the Midwestern thing, but in a sinister way. Yeah, it's a really fun voice to do. Yes.
Now, Jesse Ventura, I could talk for a long time about him, but the short version is that he was a giant wrestling superstar right before Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan took a lot of his bits, honestly, but Jesse Ventura got a bad injury at about 1984, so he had to stop wrestling right as the Hulkamania, WrestleMania boom began. And then by 86, he started to move over to film, because it also was happening for Roddy Piper. Like, the guys, they were trying to make a Hulk Hogan movies too, but WWF wanted to be heavily involved in Hulk movies. But Jesse and Roddy and guys on that level, they could get cast in other films outside of the Vince McMahon machine. Jesse's lesson he learned after being in two Arnold movies back to back was that wrestlers should really have a union, and that they have bad deals with Vince McMahon. And when he came back and said that, and tried to start a union, Hulk Hogan snitched to Vince, and Jesse got fired for that. And he's had an on-again, off-again relationship with the WWF since then. He also, thanks to a video game, was another thing Jesse sued Vince McMahon over, because they used his voice clips in, I believe, a Mega Drive WWF video game.
Oh, really?
And he sued Vince for misusing his likeness, and it was one of an early likeness rights lawsuits in video game history, and Jesse won, and so they had to be a little more careful in the future. But yes, he then he came back in and out of wrestling. There's also another person in this movie who was in the No Holds Barred, the terrible Hulk Hogan film. He's the villain of No Holds Barred.
That's right, yeah. We also have Jim Brown as Fireball. I'm just noticing now, I'm realizing there's a common theme of this movie is like non-traditional actors in this movie. So Arnold is a weightlifter. Richard Dawson's a game show host. He was an actor too. Jesse Ventura, wrestler. Jim Brown, football player. Mick Fleetwood and Dweezil Zappa are musicians. Like, yes. If you're not an actor, come on down to The Running Man. We got plenty of jobs for you.
I mean, Jim Brown had been in a lot of films by this point, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he's great, and he plays Fireball. He is the he stopped playing football in the 60s and just became an actor, and he's great in this. He's really good in Mars Attacks, movie.
Good. Yeah, he's great in that, yeah.
Well, and you know, given kind of the theme of this movie and kind of the role some of these people are playing, it makes sense to get people from outside of the traditional Hollywood world, because, you know, you have guys who worked on television or in pro sports, so they're comfortable in front of a camera, but they have kind of their own comfort zone that's outside of traditional acting, and they really bring that into the scenarios, the action, like the characters they portray. So I think it made a lot of sense.
And Arnold is such a giant man that you need to find other huge men to be around him so he doesn't look ridiculous or also could ever be an underdog in his own film. That's why they need that Sven guy to be constantly walking.
Yeah,
yeah, that Sven guy. I was impressed that they've actually found someone who was bigger, like just a more enormous slab of human than Schwarzenegger was.
It's Sven Ole Thorsen, a pal of Jesse Ventura's. He's in a lot of movies with him. I believe him and Arnold and Sven were all in Predator 4 or 5 months before that. In fact, this movie was going to release in the summer, but it was moved to November because Predator was July of 87.
Mm. Oh, well, and also, last thing about Jesse, I have a theory that I couldn't find confirmation on, but I think that Jesse Ventura refused to have his character actually lose to Arnold Schwarzenegger's character in this film. So that's why there's this weird sequence where it's robots and it's all fake. Because there's a funny story.
It's a deep fake. another touch of 2019.
We'll talk about deep fakes, but we are in the era of deep fakes and seeing this on the screen. I didn't think the same way about it when I watched it for the last time like 5 years ago.
But Jesse Ventura, there's a funny story behind the scenes that Predator that Jesse Ventura went to the wardrobe department at the start of their shooting. He's like, how big are measure my arms for my suit. My arms are bigger than Arnold's, aren't they? And he tries to put on the Arnold's jacket or some outfit he wears in the movie, and he's like, my arms are bigger than Arnold's. And then he's telling that to the behind the scenes, like, you let him know that I've got bigger arms than Mr. Olympia.
Oh.
And then it cuts to Arnold, who's like, oh, I'm so glad you told me that story, because I told the wardrobe person to make my arms 2 inches shorter on the thing to trick Jesse into thinking his arms are bigger than mine.
These hunky pranksters, I swear.
And so I think that Jesse had a real competition with Arnold. Actors do refuse to lose in movies just the way they do in wrestling.
That's
things.
That's so stupid.
This just came out about the Fast and Furious movies, but this has been around for the longest time.
Yeah, I guess it's nothing new.
Yeah, so I've seen no confirmation for this. It's just my gut instinct that I think Jesse Ventura refused to be directly defeated by Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie, and so they created this version, this fake version of it.
That's true. I mean, back
and it's a sequel hook. Wow.
Captain Freedom will return in Running Man 2.
Yes.
I mean, back in the 30s, actors and actresses would be like, this person does my close-ups. This person with this camera, they are hired to do my close-ups in this movie. So it's never been different.
Yeah.
Just like these different stipulations. But other people in this movie.
Yeah, sorry.
Mick Fleetwood, who is Mick, the leader of this people's movement resistance thing. Jeremy has a note about.
I think he's Mike in this, isn't he? Like microphone?
Oh, I thought they just called him Mick.
Oh, maybe they did. I thought it was Mike, but maybe you're right. But yes, I did put a note in there that he apparently had the acting bug around this time, because he's also notably in an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, although you'd never know it, because he is dressed as like a fish-headed alien. Like it is literally just the head of a fish.
What?
And then he's wearing robes. I don't remember which episode it was, but
wow. He
shows up in the opening credits and you're like, wow, Mick Fleetwood. And you watch the whole episode and you're like, where the hell was Mick Fleetwood? Well, he was the fish guy.
That's like having Daniel Craig appear in Force Awakens.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly the comparison.
Was he like a stormtrooper or something? I thought so. Yeah, I mean, I don't know from Fleetwood Mac, so I didn't know he was the guy from Fleetwood Mac. So good job, Mick Fleetwood.
I mean, Stevie Nicks is the real star.
Yeah. Dweezil Zappa, who is Frank Zappa's child. Mm-hmm. Dweezil and Ahmed Zappa.
Mm-hmm. And Moon Unit.
Moon Unit Zappa.
Don't forget
too.
Moon Unit.
That's true. And I know him most from being Ajax on Duckman.
Oh, yeah.
That was what he would say.
Me too. I think he also appeared on a number of those I Love the Blanks shows of VH1, or some of those VH1 talking head things.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, he's in the opening credits, so for a long time I thought the third guy of the group of three, the
Dorcas,
the fish-looking guy, I thought he was Dweezil Zappa, but no, Dweezil Zappa has one line, I believe. It's don't touch that dial.
The red beret-wearing young gentleman.
Yeah. But also Kurt Fuller.
That's the guy I was talking about who was in No Holds Barred.
And he's the villain in Wayne's World, too.
That's right, yeah.
He is, like, cast as the perfect, like, executive movie asshole, like, business asshole character is Kurt Fuller,
he's
I believe.
So good at it.
Yeah.
So good at it.
And, I mean, there's lots of other people in this movie, but one other person I want to note is the announcer of the Running Man show. He does a lot of fun bits. If you stay past the credits in the end, or stay towards the end of the credits, rather, you hear some nice, like, funny little jokes. And throughout the movie, it's Roger Bumpus as the voice of the announcer, who's also, for 20 years, have been the voice of Squidward on SpongeBob SquarePants. So just a weird pull for you guys.
Damn. I as long as Kurt Fuller is still with us, I can have my dream of interviewing him, but only about No Holds Barred, because that seems like one of the most ridiculous things ever made. And that
written by Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan?
Yes. In they said they hated the script. And they went into a hotel room all weekend to rewrite it, using probably the same techniques as Stephen King, I would assume.
A typewriter?
Yes. Yeah, that's
a very expensive typewriter.
Powdery typewriter. It's coated with a fine coating of dust.
There's more creative powder over here.
But Kurt Fuller, like in that film, just plays Vince McMahon. Like, that's the character he plays in it, which to be directed by Vince McMahon to play Vince McMahon in a script written by Vince McMahon sounds insane.
But Hulk Hogan plays a guy named Rip.
Yes, yeah, Rip. He's the Kurt Fuller also, he did a last Jesse Ventura story about Hogan. When that movie was coming out, Jesse was on the TV series. He was on WWF television still, and he was saying, like, Hulk Hogan's trying to enter my world. You can't do it, Hulkster.
He's not a governor yet. So we're going to take a brief break, and we'll come back with a discussion of the Running Man movie and the many, many games it influenced.
Hey folks, this is Bob interrupting your Retronauts podcast for a special announcement. Jeremy and I will be at this year's PAX West event for three separate panels, so if you've never seen us live before, now is your chance. So in chronological order, the first panel will be Saturday, August 31st at 12:30 p.m. in the Sasquatch Theater, and that will be the Cromulent World of Fictional Simpsons Games. That will be a Talking Simpsons panel all about all of the fake video games within the world of The Simpsons. Then on Monday, Retronauts will be closing out the show with two back-to-back panels, both in the Raven Theater. The first one will be at 3:00 p.m. and that will be Super Metroid vs. Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which is pretty self-explanatory. The next one will be at 4:30 p.m. and it's titled The Dreamcast 20th Anniversary Necromancy Jam. We'll be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Dreamcast on this panel, and it's also the 10th anniversary of the Retronauts PAX panel from 2009. Again, that is Saturday, August 31st at 12:30 p.m. in the Sasquatch Theater. That is the Talking Simpsons panel. And then on Monday, September 2nd, there'll be two back-to-back panels in the Raven Theater for Retronauts starting at 3:00 p.m. And we hope to see you there.
So we're back to talk about The Running Man and just basically a general walkthrough of the movie, touching on a few things. Of course, we're not going to go as in-depth as we do on What a Cartoon or whatever, because otherwise this podcast would be 4 hours long. But yeah, so this movie starts off with there's quite a bit of material before the actual Running Man game that we see in.
Yeah, it's like half an hour. It's a lot of content.
It's a lot of world building, if you will, to set up, establish the world in which The Running Man takes place. So the prologue after the nice video game font title is, by 2017, the world economy has collapsed. America is now a police state, et cetera, et cetera. And The Running Man is the most popular television show in history. And basically, the government controls everything, but there's a small resistance movement. And then we see that Arnold Schwarzenegger is Ben Richards. And basically, Ben is he's a cop. Mm-hmm. He's a cop.
Is he named after the members of the Fantastic Four, Ben Grimm and Reed Richards, do you think?
It could be.
I wouldn't be surprised.
He has the resourcefulness of Mr. Fantastic, yet the strength of The Thing.
And and he also is a pilot like The Thing is, too.
Oh, my God. Wow. How deep does this go?
There's probably like a Fantastic Four comic sitting on the... The desk, Stevie, like, I need a name. Need a name. Okay, that's a name. Got it, got it.
Okay, man.
Yeah. But yeah, so Ben is basically told to, who knows what he did before this, but they're flying over Bakersfield, California, and there's a food riot. No one is armed. They can tell through their helicopters, but he's told to murder everybody, murder anything that moves. He refuses to. He tries to pull a mutiny. Not a great idea in a helicopter. He's easily overpowered by his cop buddies.
Well, you know, actually, I was thinking about the whole Arnold trying to protect his image thing.
Yeah.
He's only defeated by a guy accidentally moving the helicopter wrong. He beats up all four guys in the helicopter, but him almost falling out accidentally is what stops it.
That's right. Yeah, boy, what a strange fight to be in inside of a helicopter.
Yep.
But so because of this, he is totally screwed. He is in the Wilshire detention zone, and it's a land of bomb collars. And I love any piece of media with a bomb collar in it. It's great.
Is this the first bomb collar? It definitely predates even the Battle Royale manga.
Definitely.
And same with Suicide Squad, the comic book, also was like late 80s, like 89. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if they got it from this too. I'm having trouble remembering in genre fiction any other exploding collars before this.
It's a nice touch, and it sets up a nice set piece where they have to break out of prison. They basically stage a prison riot, but in order to get out of the prison, they need to deactivate these sensors, because if they walk past them, their heads will explode, and one guy's head actually explodes.
You gotta explode one head. Yeah.
I think by this point, scanners had been out for quite a while. Same as a bomb collar, but the idea of like an exploding head was definitely there. Although, it's funny, because I watched this last night with my wife, who is not nearly as familiar with genre fiction, at least in science fiction, as I am. So I totally got what the collars were about as soon as I saw them, because it's such a cliche now. But she had no idea. So when that dude's head popped, she was like, "What just happened?"
Brain freeze.
Suicide Squad had the exact same moment, though. It came late in the movie or midway through the movie, but you have to show the threat, so you introduce a nobody character whose head is just there to explode, just so people know that they can explode.
The sacrificial skull.
But yeah, I'm sure like in some sci-fi books there were bomb collars or that'd be something. Bet, but yeah. If you were watching this in 87, this could have been new to you, the bomb collar idea. But always fun to see bomb collars. So yeah, Ben breaks out of prison. He first ends up in the slums, and he's told about the movement and everything, and he's just like, "No, I'm only looking out for myself."
He also has to smoke his stogies.
Yeah, stogie.
Arnold loves his stogie.
Oh, man. I got to say. Oh, sorry, Jeremy. Go ahead.
No, I'm just laughing about the cigars, because it's like everywhere he goes, no matter how horrible the future is, he's got a cigar.
You know what? Smoking looks cool.
It does.
When he's chomping on, I mean, I wouldn't look cool with the stogie
especially
in my mouth.
Especially with his big, manly cigar next to like Richard Dawson's effeminate fancy pants cigarette.
So yes, we meet the Resistance, and then Ben goes into the city. And
I like that Mick Fleetwood rejects him at first. They're like, "You're a cop. You made this place shitty. You suck."
But they do pry off his bomb collar. But Ben goes into the city. Like, his plan is like, "No, I'm going to get out of this. I'm going to go. My brother lives in the city. He will, you know, protect me and stuff." But when he shows up at his brother's apartment, there's a real babe living in there.
Real 80s babe.
Yeah.
Maria Conchita Alonso is at her top 80s babeness, especially with very, very 80s lingerie and high hair.
Working out.
The fact that she's exercising in lingerie, who does that? That stuff's not absorbent. Women, you're not wicking sweat away. What are you doing?
It's the future.
It. They love working out in their lingerie. Women love it.
I mean, I've been to gyms. Women do work out in lingerie in 2019.
Oh, yeah?
No, it's a lie.
Oh, I mean, I'd believe it. I don't know. But after yoga pants, anything's possible.
It's true.
I love Jesse Ventura starring in Captain Freedom's workout tape, a parody of the Jazzercise that was so hot in the 80s.
Yeah, and watching him strut around is hilarious.
His little, like, kind of Superman pose, and then he goes, "Ha!"
Yeah.
God, it's so funny.
It's great. But
And his wig is so fake, too, like, which is also great.
But basically, because of this, Ben meets Amber and kind of takes her hostage in a fun way, where Ben finds out that Amber has a travel pass. So they're going to use it to escape the country, presumably.
She's right.
It was
to be
so it was so fun when he threatened to snap her neck like a chicken's.
Yeah, yeah, but I do love his Hawaiian dad outfit
with the cigar.
With the cigar.
And she's right to be terrified of him. Not just what the media tells her, but that he's a strange man who enters her house and then does literally hold her hostage. He does commit a crime, you know.
So I guess their plan is to go to Maui or something like that, because I guess it's inferred that earlier in the movie, that's where the winners of The Running Man end up. The Hawaiian vacation is the dream for people in this reality.
Yeah, I also like that they set up that she has a lot of contraband, and then she's like, everyone does. Like, yeah, it's the future. The haves have different laws than the have-nots. That's just how it is.
It does show Ben that she is sympathetic to the cause, or she would potentially be sympathetic. But they go to the airport, and I like how you pointed this out, Henry. Even in this dystopian future, the TSA is not as bad as it is.
No way.
As it is in our world, where basically there's one travel pass. So Arnold gives the TSA guy his, which is hers, and then she pretends to not find hers and have a lot of stuff in her purse, and because it's such a big sexist hassle, they let her through.
Yeah, yeah. They just like, just go through. It's so silly.
Yeah.
Travel used to be a lot more lax.
Yeah.
I remember when you could, you know, go past the very loose security gates to wait for someone arriving on a plane at the gate that they were arriving at, instead of having to wait down by the luggage or whatever. It was a different time. But that's definitely something that stands out in the movie. So lax.
In this totalitarian future, they're like, well, it would just be one x-ray machine, though. You wouldn't have to take off your shoes and belt and scan every single thing through something. You just walk through.
It's crazy. Like, I had my wallet stolen last year, and because of that, I didn't have an ID, but I still needed to fly. So I brought my birth certificate and like every other piece of ID with a picture on it. I could find multiple credit cards and whatever. And I showed them to the TSA agent. He was like, we'll see about this. And it's just like, okay, you're getting a full pat down in front of everybody. We're going to go through your luggage in front of everybody. Mm. You are being punished, sir, for being robbed.
Gosh, yeah.
But yes, because of this, Ben is eventually caught because Amber, of course, squeals on him, because why wouldn't you?
You're being held hostage by, as far as you know, a mass murderer.
Yeah. You don't know what he's up to. And because of that, Ben is captured once again. And
they take him down like cattle. It's great.
Yes, it's very good.
How do you take down a man that large? You use a cattle net.
They use like a rope gun. Yeah.
Yeah. Though also, this militarized police can't even match the actual 2019 militarized police force. Like, they didn't have the budget to match the insane budget for war and death that America has today.
But yes,
that would have been a Michael Bay movie.
that's true.
Yeah.
But because of this, Ben is recruited by the Running Man because Damon is looking for new people, and they're all too scrawny. But they're like, oh, look at this guy running from the cops. He's the perfect contestant for the Running Man.
Yeah. Well, because he's like, oh, this guy's a murderer. Let's have him on. He's like, he's 120 pounds, if anything. This guy's too scrawny. Nobody, like, I. Dawson knows how to play both sides of Killian, the lovable game show host and then like the cutthroat television producer who's just like, what do you got for me? What do you got? Come on, give me this. Like, he's a guy who makes television, but for a, you know, dystopian authoritarian system. It's wild. He knew it, like you said, Bob, he knew exactly what movie he was in and what he is playing.
He sunk his teeth into it. So we're going to cut ahead a little bit to the actual game show. So Ben is put into the Running Man as a contestant because basically he's told, like, if you don't compete, we're going to, you know, make your two friends compete, and they could never last like you could last in this game. But it turns out, guess surprise, you got double crossed by the dystopian government, and they're also going to compete with you in this competition.
Yeah, Arnold, I mean, I don't think Ben trusted Killian anyway, but what choice did he have? But their outfits too. Maybe this is why I didn't think this movie was as smart as it was, because this is just American Gladiators, and so, well, actually, American Gladiators ripped it off. But I saw that first, and so when I saw Running Man, I was like, "What is this? The American Gladiators movie? Stupid, boo!" Like, that's how I think. Like a lot of speculative fiction about dystopias, instead of warning people, it often just gives people great ideas.
That looks nice. Let's do that. Ben is now part of this game show, and we meet Damon Killian in his true form. I love how sleazy he is. Again, a sleazy game show host. he comes out saying, you know, who loves you and who do you love? They say, Damon! So he's their hero. And he has fans of, like, there are people that show up to multiple shows. They're so excited to meet him. He gives them prizes. Mm-hmm. It's, like, a great send-up of, like, a super, like, crass capitalist mm-hmm. society. I like how there's the home version of this.
Yes, the home version of the game is great with the extremely primitive-looking packaging that they clearly just printed out in, like, 5 minutes.
It's very slapdash.
And all the posters around the TV station are so great. Confess.
The hate boat.
The hate boat.
We see a clip of, again, a very RoboCop style clip of climbing for dollars, where a guy's climbing a rope and there are dogs trying to bite him.
Even more of that in the movie.
Yeah.
So good. Like this, the film had an angle to it. I don't feel like big budget action films have as much like satire and snark to them these days, you know?
They really don't. I mean, they're not really about anything. Mm-hmm. This is kind of about
something. Well, because it has to play in every country in the world, like, to
everybody.
Trying
to understand this? I don't know. But yeah, so the Running Man starts, and basically they show the crowd a deep fake of Ben killing the people at the ride instead of, you know, protesting about their death. And while all this is happening, Amber is starting to investigate this on her own, like, because Ben is telling her, they're lying to you, I'm not a criminal. And eventually she discovers that the winners of the last competition, who supposedly went away to Hawaii, are dead.
Yes, yeah.
They're dead.
She gets her hands on much needed for later in the film true footage as well.
And you can tell it's digital because it's labeled with an optical character recognition font. They make it very clear, like, this is not the videotape that you know. It's the future videotape.
I like how, like, they save their crime evidence, like crime footage cover up evidence,
real version.
I love how we get an I'll be back in this movie. I forgot that you get one, but we also get a return. We get a response. He says only in a rerun, which is very clever.
Love that. Yeah. That's a real wink to the audience there. And also a rare time somebody gets a one-up on Arnold in one of these movies.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's okay because he dies in the end. That's what happens when you try to outsmart Arnold.
He's hoisted by his own future luge or whatever that is. So we don't have a ton of time to talk about the movie, but I do want to talk about... So this movie is essentially... We got past the intro. Now, it is a series of boss fights with a story running in the background where it's like, we got to get to the uplink satellite and show people the truth. But the movie, the meat of the movie really is these like boss fights that all the men have to fight through. And the first one is a Professor Sub-Zero.
Yeah.
He has at least a master's degree. And he is an ice skating ninja.
Love that. He's
like a hockey player. He's got a bladed hockey blade.
And he's played by Hawaiian, though portraying Japanese, professional wrestler from WWF, who was a tag teammate of Mr. Fuji, who is much more famous to 80s wrestling fans.
And they call him Professor Sub-Zero. They in fact, like, reiterated, like, Sub-Zero, Professor Sub-Zero, because it was Professor Tanaka, right?
Yeah. I think that's just him keeping his gimmick alive in the movie. And, what a cool villain in the film, too. And a good one to start with, of just this ridiculousness. Funnily enough, Arnold himself will play an ice skating supervillain in Batman and Robin.
Oh, my God. You're right. But a lot of these boss fights are very video game like. They're using the environment. They're using the enemy's weapons against them.
They have a big weak point.
Yeah.
Multiple stages to the fights.
So in this one, it starts off with him trying to attack them with the hockey stick. Then he fires exploding pucks. These are just like phases of a boss fight. Mm-hmm. And then in order to subdue him, Ben basically rips down a piece of barbed wire and strings it up across the arena, so it wraps around his neck, and then he sort of like lassos him and chokes him to death with it. So that is the death of Sub-Zero, and that's a big shock to the Running Man audience, who are not used to seeing the stalkers die.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and I know we'll get into the Metal Gear thing later, but this really reminds me of two Metal Gear battles, Metal Gear Solid's Vulcan Raven fight and Metal Gear Solid 2's Fat Man fight. Like, if you combine those, so you have a guy kind of like skating around with explosives,
yes,
but also kind of like in a, you know, like a warehouse type space and in the cold, you pretty much get this fight.
Yeah. I didn't even think of that. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about how much Kojima, I think this movie hit him greatly because he mined every part of it for content. But yeah, Fat Man, and what was the other one you said?
Vulcan Raven.
Which, what is that fight like again? I totally forget.
You're in like a warehouse full of boxes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of like scenes from the top down view, and he's stalking around with a Vulcan cannon and just like blasting you whenever he catches sight of you.
But Sub-Zero is not eaten by birds when he dies, unfortunately.
No muktuk wrestling or whatever. Muktuk eating.
We get, I think it's like Tibetan sky burial is what it's called, right? When birds eat you, something like that. I could be wrong. Correct me in the comments. But up next, so the device in this movie is they ask the audience members which stalker they want to see come out, and this nerdy guy can't decide. He loves Buzz. I forget, who does he love? Does he love Buzzsaw or Dynamo? He likes one of them, but he can't decide. But one of them will be the clear winner. Damon Killian says, "Well, do you better. Here's Buzzsaw and Dynamo." So now it's like a double boss fight. So Buzzsaw is, as you would expect, he's a guy with lots of chainsaws and a motorcycle that he can put his chainsaw on. And then Dynamo is the more inventive character, where he is an opera singing guy, like covered in light brights.
That guy's crazy.
Who shoots electricity.
He's a really insane boss for this. At least the chainsaw guy is also like a big meat slab too, Dynamo is a little heftier than the rest of the villains in this.
They say he was an opera singer too?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That is like a perfect Metal Gear boss, a electricity powered opera singer who also rides a fun Doom buggy.
That's
pretty much Vulcan, isn't it? Or Vulgan?
Vulgan,
pretty much. So, but I feel like Buzzsaw is the more classic video game villain type, because he's got two phases. He's got the bike phase, and actually that's got multiple phases. It's got like the basically using his chainsaw as a jousting lance and then just trying to run over character like the protagonists. And then he's got the second phase, which is after he's been dismounted and you have to fight him that way.
It's true. Yeah, I can see like just the idea of video game boss phases coming out rather than just being one thing you hit a lot. There's like different attacks and different ways to disable them. And then we have Buzzsaw is killed in a not interesting way. He's basically Ben pushes the saw back, but he sawed up through the crotch, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
And we get a nice like, well, he's a soprano now joke when he screams. So yep. And that's what kills him. And then we see Dynamo, basically, he overestimates his buggy's abilities. So Arnold, or Ben rather, runs up this hill of debris, and Dynamo tries chasing him up the hill in his buggy, but the buggy tumbles back down, and he is incapacitated, but Arnold will not kill an innocent man. So that is sort of a save the giant light bright man moment.
Yeah, it lets you see that he's not all bad. He's only going to kill in self-defense, and he won't kill someone so weak, which is also, though, comes and bites him in the ass, because Dynamo comes back in classic, also video game villain form of reusing a boss fight for later in the game.
It's cheap. This whole game's just a boss rush. Who wants to play this?
So I mentioned the phases of Buzzsaw's fight. It just occurred to me that the same year Zelda 2 came out in Japan, and that has a boss fight where you have to knock a dude off his horse and then fight him as a knight.
Interesting,
Kind of something in the water, something in the air.
I think all of these ideas were lateral, but definitely Kojima was borrowing heavily. So we're running out of time in terms of how long we can talk about the movie in general, but I do want to talk about some of the last bosses. So we have Fireball, who is Jim Brown, who is basically 100% the Fury from Metal Gear Solid 3. He is a flamethrower guy with a jetpack, and they're running around an industrial area like a stealth battle almost.
He's really cool.
There's like a fire boss in Metal Gear Solid 1, but this is definitely like when you see Fireball using his jetpack, that is 100% the Fury for Metal Gear Solid 3, except you can't cheese him like I did and hide in the corner and snipe him.
I mean, flamethrowing villains also need to have jetpacks. That just feels, obvious now, just that I've played so many video games. This also, I mean, this boss rush definitely reminds me of most Goichi Suda games, because they also are like big satirical boss rushes too. I think
Suda
51 had a big influence from this.
There is one more boss fight in this movie, but this is where the deep fakes come in, where Ben Richards is too popular. Someone in the crowd is asked to bet who will win, and the woman says, "Ben, I choose Ben," instead of choosing a stalker. So they get really mad, and they basically deep fake the deaths of Ben and Amber by getting stunt doubles, who are people. I don't think they're robots. I think they're people. Because
they're people, yes.
Yeah, because I think they even tell Captain Freedom, "You didn't have to kill the guy." Mm-hmm. So they basically fake footage of them being killed in like this wrestling. It's a wrestling ring.
They texture map Schwarzenegger's image onto this guy and then kill him.
And Captain Freedom is also very much the villain who has a good guy turn in films or in the video games too, like the rival of yours who becomes your ally, but you also have to fight him at the end. The only thing missing here is that he never actually fights Ventura, and he just kind of leaves the film.
Yeah, Ventura just disappears after this.
Yeah, again, my theory, I think, is true.
I think you could be right about that. But, I mean, there are no more boss fights. A few things I want to point out about this movie before you move on to the way to influence games is that I did notice, like, one definite, like, Metal Gear pull is that when Amber meets up with them after getting separated, she has the Bakersfield video. The dialogue is Ben saying, "Where did you hide that?" She says, "It's none of your business." And that was the same thing with Meryl, where she's like, "Women have more hiding places than men."
Oh, yep. Wow. I forgot that. Damn. I mean, Meryl and Maria Conchita Alonso have a little in common. Sure, sure.
When it's time to kill someone, she knows how to do it. Mm-hmm. She eventually does it. So we're almost out of time for the movie discussion. Is there anything else you want to touch upon? I mainly want to touch upon this movie is fun and it's cool, but it's all about boss fights. Mm-hmm. And once you get to the boss fights, it's a lot of fun, and you're just constantly thinking of, like, what games have I played where I see all the same stuff in?
Yeah, just action, action, action. And also that he's his striking outfit is almost like part of the joke is how he's dressed, like, well, not joke, but satire is that he's in this bright yellow costume that is not how a regular super main character in an action film dresses. But it is the kind of, like, bright colors that would be the star of a video game at the time to make him boldly stand out from the background as you're controlling him. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like the outfit he's wearing pretty much looks like the guy from Metro Cross by Namco, which is a game about a running man. Like, it's one of the first Infinite Runner type games where you're just, like, automatically running. You have to jump over obstacles and stuff, and you're wearing this bright yellow spandex outfit.
Man, I did not know that. That's his outfit's perfect for being the main character of a video game. Less so for, like, looking cool compared to other Arnold's lead characters.
The game, there was a game, 1989, it came out for MSX, ZX Spectrum, Commodore 64, Amstrad, Amiga, and Atari ST, developed by the Irish developer Emerald Software and published by Grand Slam Interactive. What I have to tell you about this game, folks, is that it's in a licensed European microcomputer action game, so no. I'm just going to say no. If you're a fan of this game, let me know. It looked like a lot of those very awkward but pretty Amiga games, and that it's fun to
watch. Sort of a Shadow of the Beast kind of thing.
Exactly. So doing this show for so long, I've looked at a lot of these games, and they all seem to be the same way in that they're all like 12 minutes long and beautiful, but impossibly hard.
Well, because there's so little content, they got to at least keep you from finishing it as best they can.
Yeah, it's like you have to draw out those beautiful 12 minutes. And I think on the Amiga version, there are two discs. The first disc is just the intro to the game. like the animated intro to the game. Yeah.
Gee,
and I mean, honestly, it's not super impressive. I've seen better Amiga stuff, but still, Amiga was all about showing off the hardware.
But Bob, it's the ZX.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, Canadians say Z too, and it just sounds like a hillbilly's name to me. Z is a letter. But again, this is the only game.
It's crazy.
There was not even an NES game. This is the perfect format for a game adaptation. And you might be saying, well, Bob, this is an R-rated movie and it's kind of violent. Well, on the NES, we had things like Predator and Platoon and RoboCop and Total Recall and Friday the 13th, all these R-rated movies that became NES games inexplicably got the Nintendo seal of quality. A-OK.
The 90s was about, the late 80s and early 90s was selling R-rated things to children in like the weirdest winky way possible.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I
was like, hey, kids, you can't see this movie, but you can buy the toys.
RoboCop is made to be a toy sold to children. That's the joke in the world of the movie. But then, of course, they made a cartoon of it so then they could sell cartoon toys to kids.
What if that joke was real and gave us money?
Yeah.
But I do want
this commentary is just smart enough to work and make us money.
I want to see Climbing for Dollars on Netflix. Mm. So I want to talk about the influence on games to close out the show. So The Running Man as a movie was never huge, but the right people watched it at the right time. So, of course, Smash TV, the 1990 arcade game.
Hell yeah.
It is just The Running Man. In fact, it's so The Running Man they accidentally stole from RoboCop, too. I'll buy that for a dollar, or I'd buy that for a dollar joke.
Eventually, you hit a wall of things to take Running Man from, so you gotta pilfer a little from RoboCop as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yes, they're in bright costumes playing a televised murder game in the future for dollars. Like that, it's bonkers how similar it is. Maybe that's another reason I didn't pay as much attention to Running Man, because I was like, I took Smash TV as a straight thing, as in not, I mean, it is a very heterosexual game, but what I mean is that I didn't see it as trying to be ironic when I played it as an 8-year-old. I just took it as fun violence game. Like, that's what I liked about it.
Well, actually, the fun violence game is Manhunt, which is the early aughts edgelord version of The Running Man. I mean, they're not that similar, but it is a death game. But I think by that time, we're getting to the point where the death game is such a broad concept that you really can't point back to The Running Man directly. But I feel like there's enough of a connection there to make a small connection. But my big theory is that this is one of the 80s movies that influenced Kojima, Hideo Kojima, creator of Metal Gear, the most.
Avowed movie buff.
Avowed movie buff. He watches every bad movie. If you look at his Twitter, you see him buying every bad Blu-ray. But so things like Blade Runner, Terminator, Lethal Weapon, all these movies were big for him, and he basically copied them directly in his video games, especially in Metal Gear. So The Running Man released in Japan after the first Metal Gear, which is why Metal Gear 2 has a boss called Running Man. And
now he's finally making that Die Hard man he's always been dreaming of.
Ooh, is there going to be a Die Hard man?
One of the villains in Death Stranding, his name is Die Hard Man.
Excellent, excellent. God, I thought you were kidding, but you're not.
Nope, not joking.
So according,
so where did Hot Coldman come from?
Oh, Icy Hot. His back was hurting one day. So Metal Gear 2 has a boss called Running Man, and according to an article that is from 2012, it's his favorite boss in the series.
Wow, I can't. I'm shocked to hear that out of all his amazing bosses, that it's the one in Gear 2, like that no American played until 2003 or whatever, when it got put out in a special edition box set.
So yeah, that is Running Man for Metal Gear Solid 2. Sorry, Metal Gear 2, and he is essentially literally a running man. He's a man who runs around an arena, and you have to lay down mines in his path. But it's definitely a nod to a movie he thought was cool. And unfortunately, because there's an enemy called Running Man in the games, it's impossible to Google Hideo Kojima interview Running Man to find out if he names Running Man ever, because it just brings up wiki articles and game facts and stuff about how to beat Running Man or who is Running Man and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's... I mean, we talked a little bit about this on our What a Cartoon about Bubblegum Crisis, but it was so influential to so many, you know, otakus of the early 80s to mid late 80s who would make video games and anime and manga, which would then into the 90s influence us. Like, it's all these films were huge in Japan. Like, it's something people didn't get at first in America when they saw Dragon Ball as well, that they're like, these are all by people who watched this is the Terminator storyline, mm-hmm. it coming in here. Same deal. I was trying to look through Kojima's feed to see if he ever tweeted about, like, I bought a copy of Running Man today on Blu-ray, but no luck. He did just buy the Japanese Blu-ray release of Army of Darkness, I saw.
Oh, that's good. That's good. My theory is this movie planted seeds in the brains of game designers to make these very theme-specific boss fights. Featuring eccentric characters whose abilities are often used against them, which is always happening in Metal Gear. Mm. But I also think at the same time, as the Running Man is released into the wild, technology for games is changing to the point where we can make more sophisticated games or more complex boss fights. Where boss fights previous to this were just like, here's a big enemy with bigger attacks, not like, here are phases, here's a new arena, here's a big enemy waiting for you. And like 1987 was also Mega Man 1. So yeah. The idea of bosses was changing a lot for game designers.
Yeah, and you know, you look at this movie and you can see just so many elements that have become just like standard fixtures of video games. I mean, you have elemental bosses here. You have fire, ice, and electric.
Yeah.
So like that's kind of your basic magic triad of spells right there. You got the, you know, like the chainsaw guy. How many chainsaw bosses have there been? And I feel like this was a huge influence on Squaresoft. I see a lot of ideas from this movie.
Are these the four
Square games from the early 90s? Like Secret of Mana, you know, you fight a guy who like rides around on a motorcycle, basically, like a flying motorcycle and tries to attack you. And then you also, you know, come across this underground resistance, and it kind of doesn't really have any purpose whatsoever. But they're just like this underground resistance there, and for some reason, it really reminds me of the way it's kind of presented here.
Hmm.
There's a hacking mini game, like memorize these numbers.
Oh yeah, that's true.
There is hacking. And yeah,
yeah,
yeah. You even have the final boss being betrayed by his henchmen. I mean, it's not like in Final Fantasy VI where he gets chucked off the side of a floating island, but it's still, you know, like Richard Dawson is expecting Sven to save his ass, and Sven is like, you're kind of an asshole and I hate you, so whatever, you're on your own. Just walks off.
Similar character beats for sure. And the also like all the sexy dames in this, all the choreographed dancing by Paul Abdul.
Oh the amazing aerobicized dancing.
I like the mournful funeral dancing. Yeah, but yeah, Paul Abdul.
They still have their spandex on, but they also have like negligee lace funeral shrouds.
Yeah. It's a very fun movie, but yeah, I went into this thinking like I definitely want to underline all of the game's influence, and there are a lot, but I think that it influenced so many things because it influenced specific creators who would then influence other people that it's too difficult to trace, and this is not me just giving up. I feel like the people reviewing this movie and watching it in 87 were not like, oh, these are video game boss fights. But if you watch it today, you can't not see that this is just a video game. Like,
yeah, I think it put the drive into the consciousness, and a lot of more people were doing it. Or even if it just taught like three game developers how to do human sized enemies who face you at the next level. Like and pace levels to that way, I think that just continued on from there, and it also it's all rolled up into one big ball of influences too. Because I've talked a lot about Streets of Fire has that kind of thing too. It had a lot of like bosses that kind of or boss tile scenarios with a few characters, not as explicitly as Running Man does it, but and I really think, you know, just in Goichi Suda's work, like Killer 7, No More Heroes, Killer is Dead, the Lollipop Chainsaw. Those are all very much built in like a scenario that puts you in a straight line through a bunch of character bosses that are very driven by characters that set the tone for their scenes, and once they're gone, then it resets to a new style for the next boss, just as Arnold goes through in this film as
it's
well.
True, I was not even thinking of Suda 51, but yeah, No More Heroes, definitely I can see the direct influence.
I mean, Suda, I got to interview him a few times. He never explicitly talks about Running Man, but he he's heavily influenced by Western media, like in so many ways.
And I believe in Japan, this movie's called Battle Runner, which is a...
That's even cooler.
Yeah, it is cool. But yes, this has been a Running Man podcast. If you can think of any other direct references games are making to this movie, let me know. Because again, it just feels like these boss fights have been the modern boss fights we've been living through for the past, I don't know, 25 years. So it feels like it might be a little too broad, but I want to know if you guys have found anything out there that could directly apply to this movie, which is a fun movie. Again, it's on Amazon Prime. There's a Blu-ray. It is an actual movie-length movie. It's an hour and 40 minutes, for Christ's sake. You can watch it and be like, oh, that was a movie. It's fun, instead of like, God, it's over. I got to pee so bad.
When I saw it was an hour 40, my initial thought was like, what a short film. And like, no, that is not a short film.
Yeah, it's a standard movie-length movie. But please watch it. It's a fun movie, and you'll see all kinds of video game stuff in it, and it's just a very snappy, well-paced movie. Lots of fun quips. Lots of awkwardly placed quips that don't really make a lot of sense given who the character is, but they're there and you can use them in your daily life to zing people.
I want a copy, Bob. I'll say that when I stab you with a pen.
Yes, you have to kill them first. Only then can you quip, but we do not condone violence.
No, don't do that.
On Retronauts, but you can stab an entertainment agent in the back if you have a good enough quip.
I love that you have a court-appointed agent. That is such a funny line. They're so... Oh, God. And the social... I mean, just watch it. Even if you don't care about how it influenced video games, watch it for the social commentary that is more real than ever.
Now. Yeah, it's a lesser RoboCop in terms of what it's trying to do.
RoboCop's still the king, baby.
Any final thoughts, Jeremy, before we give you a chance to give your plugs?
No, just that I think, you know, a video game adaptation of this could be interesting in 2019, 2020, 2025, however long it takes to make a AAA game now. You know, I think kind of just taking... maybe some notes from the book and making it more of an open world kind of thing where it's about a like environmental survival while you're being stalked. You know, I think like Metroid Fusion did that really well. It wasn't super open world, but it was, you know, kind of nonlinear, and you had these kind of set points where the SAX virus would show up and hunt you and chase you. I think like turning that into something more fleshed out, more of a proper adventure, could be really interesting. And, you know, depending on the route you take through the world, you encounter different stalkers and have to come up with different tactics. So maybe something kind of in the lines of, you know, PUBG or Rust, but more focused, more polished, more finite.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Well, we are stuck in the 80s nostalgia zone. I don't think we'll ever leave it.
No, nope,
thank God for that. Sorry for invoking Rust.
No, it's fine. But yeah, I can see that happening. I mean, it's never too late to remake this into a game or something. But Jeremy, thanks for joining us for this movie episode. I think I'll do more of these. It's lots of fun, especially returning to a movie that I recently discovered and one of my recent favorites. But please let us know, Jeremy, what you're working on. You got books, you got videos, you also have this, and your main gig, too. What's going on with you, Jeremy?
Let's just talk about the videos that I do. Besides Retronauts, I also have the Retronauts Video Works project, where I've been traveling chronologically through the catalogs of many video game systems. Currently, I'm working on Game Boy Color, which I just got up and running for high-quality video capture, and just recently covered Wario Land 2, which is amazing, and coming up in about a month or so, to time with the release of its second remake, there's The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening Deluxe, which I have written and recorded footage for and can't wait to put together as a video because I love that game.
I believe I saw you hooked up your Game Boy printer for that, didn't you?
I did, and I got a kind of decent print out of it after fussing with it for a while.
So, I'm hungry for that
cute little Link photos that are about an inch square.
I'm really hungry for the remake, and Jeremy will be at PAX.
Absolutely.
For Retronauts.
Come see both of us there.
So thanks again to Jeremy. Check out all of his videos on YouTube. Henry, you're our other special guest for this episode.
Yeah,
where can we find you and me? All these guests have something in common, and it's me.
Yes, yeah. So if you enjoy this deconstruction of a film and its cultural touchstones, you'd probably enjoy hearing me and Bob do that about both The Simpsons and a different animated series each week. That's what we do on our two weekly podcasts, Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. Talking Simpsons, we go through every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order. We're deep into season 10, baby, and we're having lots of fun. And What a Cartoon, a different animated series each week, and we spotlight a specific episode. If I could show you a recent one, maybe listen to the one we did on Bubblegum Crisis with Jeremy Parrish, the co-host of Retronauts.
Yes, and Jeremy was also on the episodes of What a Cartoon featuring the Max and G.I. Joe.
Yes, yeah, man, good times. Yeah, yeah, and that show is supported by Patreon, just like Retronauts is. Be sure to check out all the cool, many, many extras, too many to list. You can find them all at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
So as for us, this has been Retronauts, and if you want to help support the show and get all the episodes 1 week ahead of time and ad-free and at a higher bit rate, go to patreon.com/retronauts and support the show. That will get you what I just mentioned, and also will support everything that we do here, including renting studio space and, you know, airfare for Jeremy, airfare for us when we travel to PAX and things like that, lodging, of course, snacks for our guests, and so much more, hosting and things like that. So if you want to support the show and get a little something in return, please go to patreon.com/retronauts. As for me, I've been the host of this one, Bob Mackey. Find me on Twitter as Bob Servo, and we will see you next time for a brand new episode of Retronauts. Have a good one.